The Book Nook on WYSO is presented by the Greene County Public Library, with additional support from Wright Memorial Public Library, Clark County Public Library, Tipp City Public Library, Dayton Metro Library, and Washington Centerville Public Library.
Good morning. Welcome to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. Back after the end of World War II, we had the fall of the Iron Curtain, sealing off many countries in Eastern Europe as they became under the communist sphere of influence and the Soviet Union. Countries like Poland, Czechoslovakia, Lithuania, Latvia, East Germany, Estonia, they either became satellites of the Soviet Union or they were under communist rule. And back in the 1950s, that was an insult if you called somebody a communist. 35 years ago, the Iron Curtain fell, and communists became a lot less of an insult. We still have communist states, North Korea, Russia, China, but you don't go around insulting people by calling them communists, or at least you didn't until recently. That name is back as an insult in politics. What a world. Coming up, we're going to talk about communism and the prodigal spy with Joe Cannon, going back to the 1950s when our Congress was having hundreds of hearings to try to identify those communists. Let's listen.
Let's return briefly to the first book and as an intro to that, explain to our listeners that you came from the world of publishing and you made the transition to being a writer yourself.
That's right. I wasn't secretly keeping manuscripts in drawers and always wanting to vault across the desk. The way Los Alamos came into being is that I was there as a tourist and became so utterly fascinated with the place and kept thinking about it and reading more and more about it and decided that it was simply a wonderful setting for a book. And my immediate reaction was to think of some author that I was working with or knew that I could pass this hot tip on to. And then I realized that nobody probably would care as much as I did, and I would just try and see if I could do it. The story kept presenting itself, but I never told anyone. It became my secret project. I thought, what could be more embarrassing than a publisher who can't write? You'd be laughed out of parties all over town. So I just did it on my own. With very lucky, fortunate results, it happened.
Well, I have to chuckle a little bit when you refer to it as your secret project.
Right.
The book was about
the Manhattan Project, the most secret project of the world, right, at that time. It's, you know, someone had said to me, is this a sequel? And by which I think they meant, are you carrying the same characters through? And I said, you know, when you end a book with an atomic bomb explosion, it's very difficult to go on from there in the same story. But I think that it's, the segue is that it's, the origins of the book came in what I call the after story of Los Alamos. I was, the heart and soul of that first book to me, or to my mind, was the character of Robert Oppenheimer, who represented everything that interested me about the Manhattan Project and all of its contradictions and ultimately its sad consequences. And if you're interested in him, you carry through with an interest in the life. Los Alamos captures him at the high water mark. This is the moment of triumph. He's pulled off something that most people thought was undoable, and he is about to become a great international celebrity. But what happens tragically in his life subsequently is that he gets swept up in the anti-communist hysteria of the 50s. In his particular case, it was a famous security clearance board with the Atomic Energy Commission. And in a sense becomes, if not ruined, at least shattered or twisted. Things go wrong. And I became fascinated with the period. It's something that I lived through, but I lived through it as a child. I certainly saw the McCarthy Army hearings on television. I don't pretend that I had political consciousness about them. I think I was. They were just part of the general theater of the time. They were what was on television. But they nevertheless are a kind of informing period for people my age, and I think what has happened since. It was the mother lode of all the show trials. probably because they were the first that involved television. So the format, so to speak, for the shows were set up right down to the present time. But, you know, we talk about it now as McCarthyism, but this is simply a convenient shorthand one-word term. He was only one of many players, and it went on for a long, long time and involved thousands of people who got swept up. What interested me were not the stories that we knew, you know, the Hollywood Ten or fellow travelers who somehow got caught up in it. I wanted to do a story. I wanted to take Los Alamos one step further. Los Alamos was a crime story in an historical setting. And it seemed to me that the McCarthy period lent itself to what I wanted to do, which was to try a story in which history itself becomes the crime or is perceived as such by the person who's victimized by it. So we have our character, Nick, who's a boy at the very beginning of these events, who not only has to solve a murder, which is the upfront story, the pacing story, and an espionage conspiracy, but he has to solve the whodunit of the history that happened to him. He's still coming to terms with how their lives could have been destroyed and disintegrated during this very, very odd hysterical period of our time.
You're saying there was a murder in the book, Joe? I missed that. The book is The Prodigal Spy, and my guest is Joseph Cannon, author of a previous book called Los Alamos. Joe was here for the first book. He has returned from the period of 1945 when those big bombs blew up. We have a lot of polarization going on with governments around the world. Mm-hmm. We have the 1948 election where former Secretary of Agriculture Henry Wallace ran as a socialist. We have a young congressman from California, Richard Nixon, who made his career as a red baiter, who went on to become vice president in 1952. Right up to the time that the Berlin Wall toppled, we have about a 40-some year period referred to as the Cold War. This has been a rich period for writing books, novels, various suspense stories have come out of this. Now that the Cold War is over, I think there's some feeling among some readers that, oh, that's passé, we're not interested in the Cold War anymore. Some of these writers who have really made a career out of writing about that kind of period have had hard times selling books. I read this book, and I just said, wow, I mean, it was a real page-turner. I think there's still an incredible fascination with this period.
Yeah, I think the funeral is very premature. Of course, I have an interest in thinking it's premature. I think what's happening is that people who were writing as if they were reporting from the front lines, people for whom the height of the Cold War, which would be the late 50s, early 60s, was truly contemporary, we have seen the end of those kind of books. I think that CIA versus KGB shoot 'em ups and missile crisis books belong to another time. But I think I would prefer to classify this book, I mean, somebody can call it a Cold War novel if they want to. To me, it's an historical thriller. And it may be simply the twist that one's own age gives to it. Yes, I live through these events. Yes, I can remember some of them vividly. But to me, increasingly, they are historical rather than the central pieces of an adult life. Most of the book takes place in 1969 in Prague, behind the Iron Curtain. And I was there then. It so happened. I was visiting friends who lived there. Had no idea that I would one day write about it. But it seemed to me one of the most extraordinary places I'd ever been, aside from its physical beauty, which is famous and renowned. This trip took place several months after the Soviet invasion of the previous year. And it was no longer possible. The mood of the city was not just dingy and depressed and suspicious. I mean, all of the Cold War trappings, all those little props were still in place. There really were watchtowers. There was barbed wire. Phones were tapped. People did go outside to walk in parks just to have conversations. And I found all of this, I thought it had ended 10 or 15 years before that, but no, it was still very, very present there. And on top of it, there was a sadness. I think that anybody who had believed there in any future for a kind of Pan-Slavic socialism or some kind of accommodation with the history that had been foisted on them was now under no illusions whatsoever. This was no longer a satellite country. It was an occupied country. So consequently, a great depression and weariness, and yet underneath it, this intensity of feelings about everything and a real desire to connect to the West and a great intense cultural life. It was simply fascinating. And when I was doing this story, and which is essentially the story of a defector who changes his mind, and I needed to go behind the Iron Curtain, the logical place, I suppose, would have been Moscow, but I've never been to Moscow. It was as simple as that, and I can't write about places that I don't know. I think place is very, very important in a book, or at least to me. And all these memories of Prague kept flooding back, and I thought, well, let's move him to Prague. He might have gone to Moscow, but let's set this in Prague. And it all began to click into place because the visual memories or the emotions of that time, I knew to be accurate. They were truly firsthand. It was an odd way to write an historical, to use your own history to write this, but I suppose we're that old now. It still seems to me just yesterday.
You're listening to the best of the Book Nook on 91.3 WYSO, connecting our community through news, music, and storytelling, on the air and online, revisiting my 1999 interview with Joseph Cannon for his book, The Prodigal Spy. We'll bring you more right after this. The best of the Book Nook continues on WYSO, flashing back 27 years to my interview with Joseph Cannon.
The book is The Prodigal Spy, and Joseph Cannon, the author, has joined us. Joe, I really enjoyed the first book, Los Alamos, but as I was reading this new book, I kept saying to myself, as a writer, you have really come into your own. The exquisite pacing of the book just knocked me out.
Wow, thank you. You know, I think it's a richer and more complicated book, but I have been in publishing for years and I've met a lot of writers, and it's my experience that they always tend to like what they've just finished. So I can't speak for myself, but I'm glad to hear you say it because I like to hear it.
It's really true, and there's a lot more dialogue in this book. I don't know how much you want to give away about the plot, but at the beginning, you really set the hook, and it's very poignant the way you do it. Do you want to talk about what happens at the beginning of the book?
Yeah, this becomes very much a story about fathers and sons. As I said earlier, I wanted to use the McCarthy period as a springboard for the story, and I wanted someone who was truly victimized, not someone who had any political reason for being involved in this, but this is a 10-year-old boy whose family is destroyed. And he is now going to spend years trying to work out exactly what happened to them and what his father's responsibility in this was. As we open the story, we have a besieged household. His father is being attacked by the House Un-American Activities Committee, which I use specifically so that it would not be McCarthy's committee. I don't write Romana Clay's. I don't want somebody to stand in for somebody else. And I thought, well, let's shift it to HUAC. And certainly HUAC was a very busy little organization during those years. I always like to give one statistic to prove that I've done any kind of solid research at all and haven't just made it up.
Hundreds and hundreds.
Hundreds. You know, I mean, we all think of this period as something which ended with McCarthy because he popped onto the stage for about three and a half years, was censured, and then conveniently died so that everyone can say we put an end to this era. This is very far from being the truth. And HUAC, for instance, this one committee, not his, this is the House committee, in the first 10 years of the post-war period, roughly 46 to 56, called over 3,000 witnesses in more than 200 public hearings. That's a tremendous amount of inquisitional activity. This is going on all the time. They were also operating at one point as a personnel clearinghouse for employers who wanted to check the security or the loyalty of their prospective employees. And because HUAC had the most voluminous files, they were the most rabid of the groups, they became a clearinghouse. And apparently, according to texts that I've read, more than 60,000 people passed that way through these security checks, all, of course, at our expense, the legality of which I think is still a very open question. But, the point to me was the sheer scale and scope of this activity. Anybody who has spent any kind of time in the real world immediately thinks what this meant simply in terms of office life. Who was doing all this work? Where were the files coming from? And the mechanics of this inquisition, I think, are one of the things we rarely talk about now. We talk about the admittedly very receptive audience for it and the fact that we have a country that had been thrown for a loop, I think, by the beginning of the Cold War. People coming out of the ghastly World War II really wanting things to be better, wanting another world, and being caught short. Somehow things were not going to be better. You had the revelations of the Holocaust, I think, which linger forever. You have the atomic bomb, as in the first, which, after which nothing can ever be the same. These are all really traumatic moments to happen. And then here's the former ally all of a sudden. You know, it is. I am not the kind of revisionist historian who believes that America started the Cold War, if anybody could be said to have started it. But if anybody did, I think it was the Soviet Union. There's no question but that they had a very aggressive foreign policy. And no question but that they have, and have long had, a really unholy lust for espionage. So you have a populace wanting things to be better, wanting finally to get the fruits of this victory, and of course, to some extent, they are there. We become a very rich, rich country. And yet the spy trials, the revelation that somehow one was being betrayed all the time, there were willing, receptive audiences for what was happening here. So both the scale and the mood of the country, I think, play into this. And I thought, but what if it happened to you? What if you were, in this case, this boy who doesn't even understand what's going on around him? And the mood at that time was... I don't know how old you were. I was a child, and I can remember vividly in school, in elementary school, this would be after you were given the demonstration about nuclear attack and diving under your desk.
In the fetal position.
In the fetal position, but usually after you'd been shown the targets on the blackboard that showed that you were already a shadow, but you were meant to do this anyway. But I can remember vividly a teacher explaining to us the difference between capitalism and communism, which involved drawing a farm on the blackboard, and under communism you didn't own the cow. This was the way it was explained. And who then turned to us, dead serious, and I've never forgotten it, and said, "Now class, if any of you discover that your parents are communists, don't go to the police because they are your parents, but go to see your minister or your priest and he'll know what to do. He can turn them in for you." This is what was being said to children at this time. So the mood of the country was not the mood we're familiar with this year, let's say. It was a very different time. Some of it perhaps justified. There were a lot of very tortured political motivations that contributed to all of this. You know, nothing is black and white. I think it's maybe the terrible legacy of McCarthyism to see the world in Manichaean terms, that it's all one or the other. But frankly, all the great stories, to my mind, lie in that gray in the middle. So here we have this child who can't quite understand what's going on, and he sees his father in a newsreel being attacked by the committee, his father's being accused of being a traitor. And it spooks him, because what he understands just from watching the clip is that the father cannot win. The nature of the accusation alone will forever stigmatize him and besmirch his reputation, and he can never really win this battle. He also sees that the father is not getting any help at all, that there's nobody helping him. But then what truly bewilders him is that he sees something that the committee itself doesn't see, which is that the father is lying and not telling the truth, and he is utterly bewildered by this. What subsequently happens, we won't do the whole plot, but the father in fact goes away in a very early and, to my mind, painful scene. And the child, in that way that children understand things, know that he is not just going away for the weekend, he's going away for good. It interested me about defectors. I've always been fascinated, particularly by the English defectors. And I thought, well, what if one of them had been American? You know, it's that what-if scenario that starts the stories. And it seemed to me that all of those stories always end with them getting on a plane or a boat or whatever it was. And that's the end of it. And I thought, but it isn't the end of it. Surely what happens afterwards is, if anything, even more interesting. You know, it's a ironic fact, but often the most exciting thing that ever happens to a spy is being caught, because the actual work tends to be fairly humdrum. It's only when you're on the verge of being exposed, or indeed exposed, that you get the kind of melodrama that we're all familiar with. But I thought, what happens afterwards? These are people who, for whatever ideological reasons, have consigned themselves to a culture utterly foreign to them, and one that indeed is not particularly welcoming. You know, who are they going to be in this society? What's the afterlife of that decision? And then I thought, what about the people they leave? You know, what happens to those families? How do you deal with that? How do you cope? Do you pretend that if it's your father that he's dead? Do you turn it into some kind of myth of early happiness? I mean, you know, what are the issues? And that's how that all started. I don't think we can tell more of the plot, can we?
No, we can't. My guest is Joseph Cannon, and his new book is The Prodigal Spy. It's a novel, but it's definitely based on history and fact. And I believe it's still a fact that Congressman Wells from Oklahoma, who is doing a lot of the grilling for the Un-American Committee, who is grilling Nick's mm-hmm. father. Isn't he one of the House managers for the impeachment? I think he's still in Congress. Speaking of gray areas, right. Prague is a very gray area, not only visually, but everything that's going on there in Prague. You introduce all these characters, and you don't know who's on whose side, who's a good guy, who's a bad guy. And it's just fascinating, the peripheral characters that you introduce, like the guy hanging out in the bar, the former police chief. You just don't know who these people are.
I had thought, you know, the man in the bar that you referred to, this is a minor character. But one of the intriguing things, I'd come across in a book the fact that there had been a number of Americans who went to Czechoslovakia in the early 50s. Who defected personally. They weren't espionage people. They just were communists, and, you know, very left-wing thinking people, and saw that the climate of the times was very hostile to them in America, and decided to make a life for themselves behind the Iron Curtain. And I thought, well, what happened to them? What kind of life is actually being led there? Who are these people? And I thought, you know, these are not people that go to the center of the culture. They have unwittingly become marginalized just by doing this. And invariably, they're going to be drawn into some kind of information hookup. They are going to prey on other Americans who might come. But to me, it was the interest. I find that one of the central themes that fascinates me, not only about the century, but I think literature about it, is the cost or the price of ideology. It's never, I think, an excuse to be apolitical. I'm not suggesting that that we should not be political. Everybody is, one way or the other, and I think it's very important that we try to keep a clear head and be alert and be active. And yet and yet and yet, in our times, what we have seen is terrible human prices that are paid for belief systems that are so strong that one can't veer from them. And I thought, how interesting the people who traded off their life to go there willingly, not because they were called home, not because they were caught spies, but people who had convictions and beliefs, and go and choose this life only to find themselves at the end of it utterly disillusioned with what's happening there, and yet somehow pretending not to be. because if they confess to the disillusion, it's a mistake the likes of which they've never made. In the spy's case, in our protagonist's case, which is really where the title comes from, you know, most people now assume, because of the biblical parable, that prodigal means wandering or the returning because the son comes back. And this, by the way, is the inversion. This is the father who wants to come back. But in fact, what it really means is wasteful. And I think that ultimately this is the story of a man who, because of ideological reasons or having been swept up, perhaps even for the right reasons in his mind, this all begins with being an anti-fascist in the 30s. Who can object to that? But one step leads to another. And what ultimately happens is that because of the ideology, he wastes his life. He throws it away on an idea that he no longer believes in and has managed also to lay waste to the lives of those around him. It's a, I think, profoundly sad figure. And yet, he loves the son. You know, I'm a great believer in that thing with characters of two contradictions on the same parallel track. You can betray your country, you can love your son. How you reconcile those two things is the kind of thing we do in life all the time, but this is an extreme case.
In this particular story, there are a lot of prodigal people, aren't there?
Yes, wasting away and wasting themselves. It's very tricky to judge too harshly, however. One of the things I like to do in books, I find it difficult to write a bad guy. I don't know who is thoroughly bad. I suppose the closest we come to it in this book is J. Edgar Hoover, who's the only real person used, and who I have to confess was simply an irresistible character to write. I suppose I can justify it by saying that if you are writing a story about or based in the McCarthy period and somebody coming to terms with it, that it's foolish to try and understand that period without understanding the role of J. Edgar Hoover, who was absolutely instrumental in not only making it happen, but keeping it going. Nevertheless, that's the serious justification for what was really a literary irresistibility. I thought this is a character that, you know, the danger here is to make it black humor, because in 1969 he was already approaching, which is when the story takes place, he's already approaching the really grotesque period of his life where he seems to be a kind of vaudeville turn and becoming very close to a figure of fun. But of course, 20 years earlier, this was very, very far from being the case. This was a seriously dangerous and important man whose effect just spreads everywhere. The more you read about him, it's sort of like the Where's Waldo of the century. Whenever there's something bad going on, you look at a photograph, and if you look long enough, you'll find him in there somewhere. He had his hand in many pies, but certainly in the period that we're talking about, this was a high water mark for him, too.
And he shadowed much of the Cold War period, and I know when he passed away, there had to be some very serious scrambling going on among a number of people to get rid of a lot of evidence, tape recordings, and other things. Apparently, he had tape recordings of just about everybody. He might even have had some of us.
Well, I don't know how interesting they must have been to listen to at that point. I don't know. I mean, of course, we've all read the books that claim that there were the private files, then the private files within the private files, and then the files that only the secretary knew about, and God knows where the key was for that, et cetera, et cetera. And somehow, very few of these files have seen the light of day. So either one is a conspiracy theorist and thinks that certain people either have them or took care of them, or perhaps a lot of these threats were evaporated with the man who made them, that possibly he wasn't nearly as well-informed as everybody would like to think. Often what happens when the files are revealed, this was true during the McCarthy period, as a matter of fact, he would leak a lot of information to Senator McCarthy himself and several of his other favorites, and they were loath to use the files themselves because the files were so embarrassingly dumb and self-incriminating. There would be one kind of wild suspicion after another, or you'd get the account of following the suspect as he went and bought a copy of Life magazine. This would go on for hours and hours, and it was a way of seeing what the public trust was up to. When I did the part in the book about the hearings, I had an idea that possibly I could use some actual testimony and it would lend it a greater authenticity. So I was reading some of the transcripts of these trials, and for the purposes of the book, they were simply unusable. It is now in 1999 really unthinkable that this kind of exchange was happening in front of cameras or in front of reporters. But it's easy for us to be smarty and slick 50 years later. You have to put yourself in the time and empathize with what was going on then. Nevertheless, the actual transcripts, I thought, all you can try to get here is a flavor or a mood, but if you really use them, it becomes almost comic, you know, which God knows it wasn't.
And, of course, it was a matter in life of life and death or careers for many people. People died. People were blackballed forever. This was very serious stuff, even though it seems ridiculous in retrospect.
Yes, and particularly jobs. I mean, occupation was the great point of leverage for this era. I always try to be even-handed about this, and there's a danger in running too far, which is that however terrible it was, and I do believe without any question that it was the longest sustained assault on civil liberties this country has ever known, and maybe as close as we have or will come to the beginnings of a police state, it was a terrible time. And yet, having said that, it is not remotely as deadly and serious as what was going on in the Soviet Union. That was a real police state. Their death was a real option and under their show trials and under their purges. Here it was more often a case of ruined reputations, careers that would be derailed, jobs that could not be found, all of them terrible things in themselves. But we didn't have a gulag, and there's a point where one has to keep some perspective about it before we decide that it was six of one and half a dozen of another. It was never that. McCarthy may have been a crazy, reckless, dangerous person, but Stalin was a monster. You know.
He certainly was, and I had not heard about his son until I read your book. Was that true? Did he have a son who was terrible
yes.
too?
Yes, this is there's an anecdote in the book which was based on a true story that I'd come across in biographies of Stalin, which is he had a son whom, you know, he treated badly because he treated everybody badly, and who became a drunk and a wastrel and somebody that would have girls around him all the time and was just one of those political liabilities that Stalin's inner circle would have to keep quiet and take care of. And at one point, he insisted on flying a hockey team, I think, right? Oh. Or a soccer team, into a blinding snowstorm because he wanted them to meet some, to play that night.
That really happened.
That really happened.
Oh, my.
What happened was that the plane went down, and nothing was ever said about it.
Uh-huh.
None of the survivors' families ever knew what had happened to it. It just, people vanished. And I used it as an anecdote about how very extraordinary that society was. I mean, the usefulness in terms of the story is that Nick is trying to understand how his father could live here. What does it mean to be in a place where people are always listening to you? Where I say at one point, it isn't the knock on the door at night, it's just listening to a car idling in a quiet street and knowing that someone is being arrested and taken away. To live in that kind of constant fear, it's horrific beyond anything we can imagine. We're very lucky people.
You're listening to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO, going back to 1999 for my second interview with Joseph Cannon. And we'll bring you the final segment from that conversation right after this. This is the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO, and our final segment of an interview I did back in 1999 for an espionage novel, when I talked to Joseph Cannon about it. The Prodigal Spy was the name.
It brought back memories for me, reading about Prague and about how There was such constant surveillance. You never knew if you were being recorded. You didn't know who was watching you. You didn't know who you could trust. I was very briefly in East Berlin in the early 70s, and I can remember going to a park, this big, beautiful park with wide expanses of green space, and there was nobody there. And I found that so strange. And you got that feeling, that 1984-ish feeling that Big Brother was watching. This big, beautiful expanse, there's no one using it. Now, why is that? But there's this busload of tourists standing there looking around going, oh, this is the future. This is so wonderful.
Right. It's not, is it? You know, after the so-called Velvet Revolution, when the Czech Republic finally became itself, it was revealed that there were literally thousands of people on the payrolls who did nothing but monitor phone calls. It was actually one of the legitimate occupations in these countries. It just happened all the time. They would tap in and out of conversations. You would meet people who were drummed out of one cultural union or another because they had participated in Prague Spring in 1968 and now had to operate trams or just do some kind of publicly humiliating work as a lesson. You know, these are all, I suppose, familiar things, but when you confront them personally, you're brought up short, and you think it isn't just a question of things you've seen in movies or an abstraction about different systems. You see what it really does to people's day-to-day lives. It's terrible. And I think, you know, in the story, part of what happens with Nick is that he cannot understand how his father could ever have chosen this. And of course, it turns out the father didn't choose it. It was chosen for him. And so we
No, don't give anything away.
A double layer of intrigue.
Go on.
It's so hard to help oneself, right? Uh-huh. But we don't want to write it all over again on the air. Anyway, there's a lot there.
The book is The Prodigal Spy. I found elements of almost slapstick humor in it as well, because this young man, Nick, the son of the defector, he has this acutely sensitive side to him where he remembers these things, these little things that happened when he was a little kid, when his father was leaving. He remembers incidents. He remembers things that are said at dinner parties that end up being things that he uses later on, and yet he does these ridiculously absurd things when he's being Mr. Junior Spy.
Well, wouldn't we? You know, I think one of the interesting things is that the spies themselves do absurd things when they're being Mr. Junior Spies. It is quite interesting when you get into the literature of the real, you know, if we want to call it that, and actually read the accounts of people who have done espionage work. A few things always strike me forcibly. One is that I can never get a sense that any actual secrets are passed. What they tend to pass on is news of each other, so that the most valuable spy to catch is the one who actually knows who the spies are in your territory, and it becomes this endless game of mirrors where they're simply trying to catch each other. The other thing that strikes one is that the only way they seem ever to be caught is through informers, and so one of the things they're always alert to is betrayal by their own side. It comes with the territory. And then the third thing, which we referred to earlier, is simply the humdrum day-to-day existence that most of them perform. Now, I'm not talking about the spies at the very highest level who were, and who indeed became the famous, Philby and Burgess and Maclean and those kind of legendary spies. Obviously, great and important secrets were being taken out. But for most of the others, unless they're simply not telling us, it's not a job that I think anybody with an ear for excitement would really apply for. I think, it has a downside. It is particularly true now, though. You know, earlier you said about the Cold War, and is this really going to end as a subject? I think that espionage fiction, because it involves questions of betrayal and loyalty, deceit, things that we encounter on one level or another in our private lives all the time, but here in extreme dramatic form, I think it has an unending kind of interest for us. There are simply great stories that come out of it. And in this particular instance, one of the reasons I think that as a period it will continue to appeal to writers, is that it may be the last, or at least the last in the West, where these things were done for ideological reasons. It's not very interesting to write about somebody who wants to betray his country because he wants $25,000. It's, you know, what can you say? He's a jerk. But what about the people who really believe in what they're doing, who really think they're doing this for the right reason, for a cause that's going to help humankind or whatever? That's a much more interesting, to take that step, to take that leap into actually betraying your own. You know, I don't subscribe to the E.M. Forster, there's a famous line of his about, if given, you know, I'd rather betray my country than betray my friend. I think it's a false choice. I think that people in that position invariably end up doing both. I don't see that it's possible to make that distinction. And once you start down that path, betrayal becomes a way of life. I mean, we have famously Kim Philby. There he is in Moscow after he's defected, and he begins to have a extramarital affair with McLean's wife. You know, he can't help himself. He's simply a betrayer.
Well, it was definitely a strange period. I've only really experienced it in books, and when I read about Whitaker Chambers' Pumpkin Patch and things like that, it just seems almost laughable, but this was really life and death stuff.
Defies fiction, doesn't it?
It's unbelievable. The book is The Prodigal Spy, and my guest is Joseph Cannon. You might recall that he was on the program a few years ago with his first book, Los Alamos. What's the response been so far to the new book?
Well, so far, wonderful. I'm sort of knocking on wood here, even in front of the microphone, because, you know, you're appealing to a lot of people, and a lot of people have very, very different opinions. And so far, it's been wonderfully, you know, positive. Naturally, of course, people always say that to me. So, I don't know if I leave the room if they say something else, but I hope not.
Cannon, your book stinks.
Yeah, right. And, you know, the reviews have been wonderful and like that. So we'll see. The Literary Guild has taken it as a main, which is always a nice sign. And it seems to be out there, and I'm having a good time going around talking about it. I find that, as with Los Alamos, when you do a bookstore event, you know, a signing, and actually interact with people who are interested in the subject or have even read it, that there's a wonderful thing happening with young people. There's simply a hunger to know about these things. They are not taught. I mean, on the first one, I was dismayed and disconcerted and made to feel about 80 years old when people would come up to me and say, now, I know in the book that some characters are real and some characters are made up. Now, is Robert Oppenheimer, was that a real person? And I would sort of take a breath. This was, in my childhood, one of the most famous people in the world.
It's, well, these, like, are the same, you know, people that don't know the capital of South Dakota, so don't feel bad.
Pierre? Right. Or was that North? No, I got it right. It's true. I think there's a great amnesia, and maybe this is, in some ways, a good thing. I don't believe that people should dwell incessantly on a past that can't resolve itself, because we all move on to another future. And I don't even know that I believe that history has great lessons to teach us. But I think that it has wonderful, wonderful stories. And how can you not be interested? The lesson I think ultimately it has to teach is simply about human behavior. We should not be so surprised. I mean, look what we're seeing now. It's, you know, I said earlier this was the motherlode of all the show trials that came afterwards, and there's this terrible irony of always becoming your own enemy. You're becoming your enemy. You know, there we were, literally performing acts that were very much similar to what we were accusing the Soviets of doing. And then the various hearings that have followed. And now, of course, everybody wants to talk about sexual McCarthyism. I think that I have very mixed feelings about that term, by the way. I think that, you know, on the one hand, yes, the cast of characters seems straight out of central casting. It's almost like you can take some of these guys and put them in a film about this period 40 years ago, and they'd look exactly right in the part. And you've got the same format and the same social sanctimoniousness and the same congressional lust for publicity. They'll do anything to be on camera. And yet and yet and yet, I think that whenever I hear the phrase, you know, section, and I've been hearing it now in the past few weeks because the connection between the book and what's going on, to me it somehow diminishes the real McCarthyism. I think what's going on now is essentially frivolous. Whatever else McCarthyism was, or that period was, and sometimes it seems to us absurd, it was never frivolous. It was about very serious and real and substantive issues, and it affected thousands and thousands of lives. And it had, as we said earlier, a receptive audience. They were not playing to an empty auditorium, you know.
The book is The Prodigal Spy. And my guest has been Joseph Cannon. I see we've just about run out of time here, Joe. With all the consolidation going on in the publishing industry and your experience and background in that industry, there has been speculation that I've read in a number of publications that it's going to become more difficult for young, unknown writers to get their books published. Do you have any thoughts on that?
You know, it's... The one thought that I always have is that I've been hearing this ever since I got into the business, which was in the late 60s. I don't mean to be flip about it. I think it's never easy for a young, struggling writer to find an advocate, to get published, and to be treated the way that anybody would like to be treated. It's a tough row to hoe. On the other hand, I personally have never experienced a situation where they publish 50,000 books a year.
And they're all good.
Well, some of them are, right? So there are a lot of shots at this brass ring. It's not like movies where, because of the expense involved, there are people who may never get a chance to do anything ever. I think that people who are interested in writing and they're interested in a serious way and have any talent at all usually get some chance at it. I don't think that the industry blocks it out. I think they really are looking for new talent. I don't mean to be a Pollyanna about the publishing business. It's got its downside too. But the economics of it and the structure of it are such that it welcomes new talent. In fact, I think it's easier sometimes to get a first book published than the second one, because then you're running up against track record.
Gotcha. Joe, one more question before we go. Do you have another book in you?
I hope so. Yes, I'm writing it now. I did the research, and when I'm finished talking to you and the few other people and I go back home, I will start actually writing it. It's, again, a book that I think uses this period. It looks at history, or our recent history, and has the elements that I find I'm really comfortable with. You know, I like a book with a love story, and I like a book with intrigue. And what I would love is to have someone say, you know, this has the entertainment quality of a 40s movie, let's say. You know, it sort of kept me interested.
Film noir.
A film noir. It kept me going. And yet is also about something. And it causes you to just look at it again, or even become more interested. But to me, the best thing that ever happened with Los Alamos is that people would come up to me and say, I never knew anything about the project. What books can I read to learn about it? And I'd say, you know, we grew up under the mushroom cloud. And isn't it interesting to know who put it there and what they were thinking about when they did so? It wasn't necessarily Dr. Strangelove. It could have been you.
You've been listening to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO, going back to 1999 for that interview with Joseph Cannon for his novel, The Prodigal Spy. He's gone on to a long career as a novelist. His most recent effort was called Shanghai. And I loved the way he gave long, thoughtful answers, and he has that wonderful voice, very expressive. And he had a certain expression that he used several times during that interview where he said, and yet, and yet, and yet. I like that. Don't miss the Book Nook tomorrow, 10:30 tomorrow morning, when I'll be interviewing the author of a book that is my favorite novel so far this year. You won't want to miss it. It's an incredible novel. It's science fiction, it's fantasy, it's mystery, written by a gentleman named Tom Lin. It's called, believe it or not, The title is Babylon, South Dakota. That's right. It's set in South Dakota, and there's a missile silo on their land. And a lot of really strange things are going on. And talk about the Cold War. This is the height of it. That's coming up tomorrow in the Book Nook, 10:30 tomorrow morning. Have a great day.